Hey, quick heads up. This is episode 3 of a special 6-part season of BioPodcast. We spent the last 8 months of 2025 following 4 biographers as they navigated everything from blank pages to book deals to total silence from publishers. If you're just joining us, start with episode 1. You'll want the full picture. All right, here we go. In the last episode, Sarah discovered the trap of unending research. Kate went to Concord before sunrise for her first book launch event. Kevin went to Howard and came back with some research gold. And Katie Rose was ferociously working up to her due date. That was the work. Now, the part nobody tells you about. The money, the agents, the silence, and the publishing industry nobody warned them about. This is episode 3, The Business. In December 2025, Sarah sent her editor at Grand Central the first chapters she'd written. Her editor read them, responded, and Sarah did something I love. She took the feedback, copied and pasted the best parts, and printed them out on a piece of paper with a header in enormous font.
She gave me some advice moving forward that I copied and pasted and printed out on a piece of paper that has in huge font at the top, good advice.
So what was on this sacred document full of good advice?
Be mindful of your joke rhythm and frugal with footnotes that function as punchlines. That's always true, whether you're writing for the stage or for the page.
For most biographers, that's not a note you'd ever get. But Sarah is a comedian writing biography, and her instinct is to go for the joke, to undercut a sincere moment with a wink, and use footnotes like asides in a stand-up set.
So often, it's easy for me to go for the joke or to go for the wry undercutting of the sincere statement. And that's just not the way it works in certain forms of writing.
This is the business of trade publishing. You have an editor who reads your work and tells you the truth. Sarah's truth was, you're funny, but this isn't a comedy special. Dial it back. The other piece of business, Sarah's delivery schedule had changed. Originally, her editor was going to review chapter by chapter. Now, Sarah was sending a bigger chunk, between a third and half the manuscript.
But after, you know, she's looked at the first couple chapters, we're like, okay, yeah, ready to do a big chunk. And so in April, I'm planning on handing her somewhere between a third and half of the final manuscript, probably closer to half.
Half the manuscript by April. And then came the moment that made me laugh out loud.
I started to get really nervous because I forgot to look at my contract and see what my actual date of.
I think it's this spring.
No, it's August 1st.
She forgot her own deadline. Months of false panic, gone in one glance at the contract.
So I totally was operating under the assumption it was the spring. Literally, it's August.
August 1st, 2026. Not spring. Sarah had invented a deadline that didn't exist. Panicked about it, and then discovered she had months more than she thought. In trade publishing, you have a contract, a deadline, and an editor who gives you notes you print out in giant font. But you're still alone at a foldable desk at 5:30 in the morning, panicking about a date that you made up. Kate Culkin's book came out in July. By January, I had one question for her. How did it sell?
I do not know anything about the sales. I did publish with a university press, University of Massachusetts Press, and my experience with them when I published my first book is that they send you something like at the end of the fiscal year, so like next June.
Kate's book published in July 2025. She won't know how many copies sold until June 2026. That's a whole year of not knowing. She'd looked the book up on WorldCat, the global library catalog, and found it in over 230 libraries. That sounds great, until you read the fine print.
That number is slightly deceptive because some of that is JSTOR. It's in a package. So people have access to the book, but not the physical book. They have, basically an ebook version through JSTOR and they can download the PDFs of it.
If you've been to college, you know JSTOR. It's a database where academic papers live. Kate's book was bundled into a JSTOR package, which means that libraries could claim to have it without a single physical copy on any shelf. 230 libraries. And who knows how many of those are actually holding a book you could pick up. Kate had started a campaign. She was asking people affiliated with libraries to put in requests for the physical book.
One thing I've actually been doing is been asking people who are affiliated with an academic or public library to put in a request to purchase the physical book. Some libraries won't do that if it's in JSTOR, but JSTOR, the subscriptions can come and go. Like right now, it's in that their subscription. But if a library cancels JSTOR or they change the books that are available, then the book is no longer available in that library. So that's just a little plug for asking your library to purchase books by people you know or books that you like.
A one-woman library acquisition campaign. But you know what? Those DIY events she'd set up worked. Tours at the Emerson House, the actual house where Ralph Waldo Emerson lived, sold out.
I structured it that most of it was quotes from the sisters talking about being in the house or their family life. And it was great. We did two, and then they wanted to do two more because those sold out.
At one of the tours, the Emerson House staff pulled out something extraordinary.
And they brought out three of Edith's dresses, which had just been like in a dresser there, like untouched for decades. And they were beautiful. And one was like a maternity dress. I'd never seen a 19th century maternity dress.
Kate had spent years writing about Edith Emerson's 8 pregnancies. And here was her actual maternity dress, pulled from a dresser untouched for decades, held up for a room full of people who now knew Edith's name because Kate wrote the book. Then Kate's uncle, a professional tour guide, brought his friends to one of the events.
People from Concord coming. I had people I knew at all of my events, people I went to college with and I had not seen in a couple decades came, which was really nice. At one of the tours, my uncle, who is a professional tour guide, invited his friends who do tours in New England to come. That was great. And they're going to integrate information about the Emerson sisters into their tours of, New England now. And it just made me realize, like, there's just many people who can help you promote your book beyond sort of the usual suspects.
Tour guides across New England incorporating the Emerson sisters into their narratives. No marketing department arranged that. An uncle did. And then Megan Marshall, the biographer who won a Pulitzer for her book on the Peabody sisters. The same Peabody sisters who were connected to the Emerson world that Kate had been writing about.
Megan Marshall interviewed me for the Thoreau Society. And of course, that was just like an honor. She's such an important historian in general, important American historian and biographer. And particularly for my work, her work on the Peabody sisters, was fundamental to my being able to make an argument for writing about the Emerson sisters.
The biographer whose work made Kate's book possible was now interviewing Kate about that book. That's not a sales number, but it might matter more. Kevin McRuder's agent had been shopping his Fisher project. The feedback from publishers was diplomatic. Kevin was less diplomatic.
Some of it has to do with the political moment we're in. She has said it is a challenge. She didn't put it this way, but reading through the lines, I think publishers are affected in the same way that other businesses are by this wave of anti-Blackness that is not named that. But when you see what people are doing, that's what it is.
Of course, nobody's going to say, we don't want to publish a book about a Black writer. But the rejections pile up. The interest is tepid. The market, they say, is tough. Kevin had been through this before. His previous book, a biography of Philip Peyton, the Harlem real estate pioneer, came out through Columbia University Press as a $54 hardcover.
the Peyton book, it came out in paperback because I really pushed. I said, like, Race and Real Estate, it was like $54 in hardcover. And it's like, I want to write for everybody, really. And so even as I'm thinking about, you know, kind of writing as craft.
There's a gap here that Kevin is trying to close. Academic presses respect his work, but they don't know how to reach a general audience. Trade publishers can reach that audience, but they're not exactly lining up to publish a biography of a Black writer from the 1920s that most people have never heard of.
My goal was to try to break out of the academic market. I appreciate Columbia University's press and the opportunity I had there, and they may be interested in this too, but I felt that there wasn't an intention of reaching a broad audience. Like with both books, I did a fair amount of marketing because I'm used to doing events and things like that. But I'm not writing just for academics. Like there's a lot of people in Harlem who are very interested in knowing more about the place where they live. And I want them to read what I'm writing.
Kevin wants people in Harlem to read his book about the man who helped interpret Harlem to the world. And to do that, he needs a trade publisher. And to get a trade publisher, he needs to prove that an academic can write a page-turner about a subject few have heard of, in a market where the unnamed wave makes everything harder. One publisher was still interested, but they wanted to see more. While Sarah has an editor and Kate has a university press and Kevin has an agent, Katie Rose Quant has a $25 website subscription.
So I've used this website called Publishers Marketplace. It's a subscription, but it's like $25 a month. It's not wildly expensive. So I've had that for the last couple of months, and you're able to kind of go through. You can search books you like, or, you know, authors you admire, and it does a pretty good job of matching you with who repped their books when they got their book deals. So that kind of helps put together a little bit of a list of agents who might be interested in your type of book.
That's the infrastructure of breaking in. Katie Rose had also gone to an event at the CUNY Graduate Center where agents spoke to students. Their advice was specific.
And they kind of gave this kind of advice of really trying to curate who you reach out to in the first place. Obviously, you want to find someone who's a good match for your project and for you. So that's what I've used mostly to kind of track down some ideas.
Takeaways: curate your list. Don't spray and pray. Research the agents the way you'd research a biographical subject. But Katie Rose had a networking problem. She had come to biography through journalism, not through the literary world.
People in my like social circle that I've had over the years are not really authors. But since I went to this master's program on writing biography, I have met people who have sold books or, you know, have written books. And I think if I were really interested in an agent and I sort of knew someone who knew someone, that might be something I would reach out and just kind of get their advice on approaching their agent. My friends aren't all authors. So yeah, networking is so hard, and just trying to figure out like the most strategic, respectful, smart way to do that is something I've been starting to think about.
In publishing, connections matter, and Katie Rose was building hers from scratch. She was also applying for every fellowship she could find.
I did apply for, there's like through the New York Public Library, there's a big book writing fellowship. I applied for that. I applied for one through the Leon Levy Center, which is another big biography one. There's a few more coming up, some through Biographers International. I've seen that they have some pretty cool like research grants and stuff. So I have a few upcoming deadlines on my calendar as well. And I've been trying to focus on that a little bit more. So a few things pending, a few reaches pending, but you have to apply. You'll never get it if you don't apply.
Katie Rose was playing the long game. Publishers Marketplace, fellowship applications, a curated list of agents, and a proposal she was still refining. These four biographers come to the business of publishing with four completely different relationships to it. But here's what this episode is really about. Nobody becomes a biographer for the money. Nobody does it for the marketing support. You do it because you believe a story needs to be told. And then you discover that telling the story is only half the job. The other half is figuring out how to get it into the world. Sarah's editor told her to be frugal with her jokes. Kate's press told her nothing at all. Kevin's agent told him between the lines that the market has a problem with black subjects right now. And Katie Rose's mentors told her, curate your list, apply for everything, and don't give up. Next time, challenging the canon, Sarah takes on Saint Abraham and discovers that the real Lincoln story includes a mass execution she was never taught about in school. Kevin finds something on a death certificate that changes everything. Katie Rose reads congressional testimony from a century ago that sounds like it was written yesterday. And Kate has to figure out what to do when your biographical subject turns out to be a racist. The ideas, the arguments, the reason they're doing this in the first place. Four Paths, One Impossible Dream is a production of BioPodcast and Biographers International Organization. Ellie and Marie Fillengaines created our theme music. Carolyn Van Putten is our assistant producer. Sheree Newman is our engineer, and Sonia Williams is our executive producer. I'm Jenny Skoog. Special thanks to Sarah Benincasa, Kate Culkin, Kevin McRuder, and Katie Rose Quant for letting me into their lives and their work. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org.